When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
So where have you kept the award then?
It's on the mantelpiece.
Nice. Good yes. Choice. Classic.
Definitely.
I think you either go mantelpiece, you can go doorstop, or you can go next to the toilet. Those are the three
exactly.
Classics.
Well, when I get a sort of whole fistful, then some of them can go in the toilet. In case people don't know, this is the award we won at the British Press Guild.
Yeah, the Broadcasting Press Guild Awards last week.
And then we went off to celebrate in Austria.
We did. We went on our first holiday together,
exactly.
Ed and myself, because they say that is a big test
of any
relationship. You know, you've been together a certain amount of time.
6 months in our case.
Yeah, and then you go away and you see how it holds up.
Yeah, I think it went pretty well, didn't it?
I think so too.
Yeah.
We were at a radio conference called Radio Days Europe in Vienna.
And we did a nice little turn about podcasting.
We did. That was very enjoyable. And as well as that, we got to go to the City Hall.
Yes.
The Rathaus.
And we're going to be hearing from Mr. Czernohorsky. The reason for that we went to interview him is that Vienna, in fact, the day after, Jeff, we interviewed him, was voted for the 9th successive year as the best city in the world to live in.
You could have a second chapter in Austria.
You think so?
They seem to really like you over there.
Yeah, I'm not sure they wanted me to run for Chancellor of Austria. So we're going to be talking this week about the idea of wealth funds, essentially government or so-called sovereign wealth funds. The best way of explaining this is that Norway used the money from its North Sea oil, not in the way that Britain did to sort of spend each year, but to put the money aside. And since doing that, that fund, and it's mainly invested in the stock market, is now worth over $1 trillion. I mean, that's just a huge amount. It's more than 1%. They own more than 1% of the world's stock market.
Wow.
And the advantage of that, I suppose, is a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it's government putting money aside for a rainy day, which is one of the ways the Norwegians think about it. But secondly, stock market wealth has tended on average to grow more quickly than the growth rate of the economy as a whole. And therefore, it's a way of government making sure that it has a share of that on behalf of the people. And now some people in Britain are saying, well, we should establish one of those funds and we should use it to then use the proceeds or the interest to redistribute wealth among the population, because wealth inequality is a massive problem. It's much bigger than the income inequality in our country, the gap between rich and poor in terms of their annual income. The amount of wealth people have, the divide there is much bigger. So there are some ideas around, and we're going to be talking about them, for how you can use one of these sovereign wealth funds as a way to make the distribution of wealth in our country fairer.
And Goopgate continues. Your thoughts on that?
Yes, for those who don't know, Goopgate is all about the perilous sandwich situation across our country and what can be done about all of the goop that and we've had a we've been flooded with goop people who are on my side on Goopgate.
I mean, I'm just brainstorming here, but how's this for an idea? You launch your chain of make your own sandwich shops. Yeah. They become nationalized and the profit from that goes into some kind
good
of sovereign
idea.
Wealth fund.
Yeah, you're onto something.
Do you still feel confident in your own business idea?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd want to sort of bet the farm for the whole nation on them. But I think it's got something going for it.
So do you have a reason to be cheerful?
Yes, I do. I'll read you from the New York Times and I think this will explain why I'm cheerful about this. This is a story of a little gay bunny. A little gay bunny who belongs to Vice President Mike Pence. A little fictional gay bunny. This is a story of Marlon Bundo, the Instagram star and real-life pet of the vice president's family, who's also the subject of two dueling children's books released this week. So basically, the daughter of Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, wrote a book called Marlon Bundo's Day in the Life of the Vice President. And it's a picture book that focuses on Mike Pence's rabbit, right? Yeah, I don't have a rabbit, but I mean, surely I should have done this. I might have been a great success. But then John Oliver, who presents the show Last Week Tonight on HBO, decided that he would write a rival book about a gay romance between two bunnies. And so far, that book is the most popular of the two. Now, it should be said that one of the reasons he did this, and the proceeds are going to charity, one of the reasons that John Oliver did this is that Mike Pence's views on homosexuality are pretty rebarbative, really,
yes.
Because there's been this whole controversy about whether he supports gay conversion therapy and all of that stuff. John Oliver has decided to engage in some one-upmanship, and there's this book that he's written called A Day in the Life of Marlon Bundo, and it's already sold 180,000 copies as of
wow.
this article. So there you go.
That's great.
So that's quite good, isn't it?
He's brilliant, John Oliver.
Yeah, he is brilliant.
My reason to be cheerful this week is I just came from a thing this morning. I was on a panel about laughter in the workplace.
Right.
And I was on there with a former colleague of mine called Sue Todd, who works in media marketing for the magazine industry. And then Professor Sophie Scott, who did a wonderful TED talk on laughter. Paul Coleman, who created the Peter Kay car share show on the BBC. And then Bruce Daisley, who is the managing director of Twitter in this country. But he also hosts a podcast about workplace culture. And he gave a great fact that, so, you know, booze in British companies has been a big part of the culture. And, you know, if people think about the fun they have at work, it's often, you know, when they've been to the pub and so on.
Yeah.
And that's changing, and especially millennials. So to replace that, I forget the name of the company, but a company that he talked to have introduced something called Crisp Thursday, where employees are encouraged to bring in different types of crisps every Thursday. And then it's like a wine tasting only with crisps.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, maybe.
I think we do a lot better than other countries on flavours of crisps. That is my observation.
Uh-huh.
The Americans tend to, from my observations there, tend to be quite limited in flavours of crisps. What's your favourite flavour of crisps?
Well, you know, I think I'm a salt and vinegar guy. I do like the classics.
I really don't like salt and vinegar. It's the one I don't like. We found our incompatibility. It's a good job you didn't buy some salt and vinegar Pringles on the plane.
Isn't it?
No, I like cheese and onion, but I really don't like salt and vinegar.
Well, in the same way as this podcast, I think, sometimes reaches across the political divide, we are reaching across the cheese and onion, salt and vinegar divide.
Yeah, Monster Munch.
You're not a fan?
No, remember, we're going to do word association.
Oh, right. Square crisps.
Salt and shake.
Space Raiders.
Frazzles.
I'm not sure this is word association more than it is just naming crisps.
What's the association of crisps? Frazzles.
Nerves.
Nerves?
Well, you said it's word association, so it's either word association.
No, stay with the
so
crisps.
So I thought frazzled nerves, or it's just naming crisps.
No, keep going until he wins.
You consider this to be a game?
Yeah.
Okay. KP skips.
Big D peanuts.
A peanut is not a crisp.
No. It's what came to mind. Mini cheddars.
Scampi fries.
Bovril flavoured crisps.
Prawn cocktail flavoured crisps.
Oh, I think you might have got me.
You could have had hedgehog flavoured crisps.
I'd have thought of that, but then I thought that was too absurd. Oh, Quavers.
Hey, I'll tell you what, it's easy to see why they gave us that award, isn't it?
Quavers. I've got you.
Hula hoops.
Good one.
Don't say I've got you when it took you 30 seconds to come up with Bovril flavoured crisp.
Pringles.
Estrella.
What?
They're a type of crisp.
Nachos.
McCoy's.
I mean, basically, you're too good at this game. I tip my hat to you. You found your true talent. You can win crisp word association anytime.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're joined now by Angela Cumine, who is an author of a book called Citizens' Wealth, Why and How Sovereign Funds Should Be Managed by the People, for the People, and is an academic expert on these issues. Angela, thanks so much for joining us from Australia.
Great to be here.
Let me ask you, first of all, if you can just give us the basics. What is a sovereign wealth fund?
Yeah, well, as its name suggests, it's a pot of public wealth that the government owns and controls, and it invests in financial markets for a return. So it's basically like a big savings and investment account that you might have as an individual, but in this case it's in the government's hands, and it's full of assets and underlying reserves that are usually sitting in the public coffers.
And we'll come on to some of the contemporary issues about these things, but what's the history of this idea, and so why has it been advocated in the past?
Well, the idea of the sovereign wealth fund is actually quite a long-running one, although it's only entered the public discourse in the last 10 years. But some of the oldest funds date back to the 19th century. So we had a couple of funds set up in Texas and one in France after Napoleon raided the public coffers there, and the French state wanted to set up a fund that would stop an individual leader raiding the treasury. But it's really only been in the last 10 years that many governments around the world have started to cotton on to this idea and realise that it's quite a powerful tool of economic policy and a disciplined way to help save. So more and more states are quite evenly spread across the world have been setting these funds up either on the back of large commodity surpluses or a big increase in their central bank reserves in the case of some of the East Asian states.
Why might it be the case that governments want this? Because the way we think about governments normally is they get in the taxes, they spend the money, maybe they're in deficit, maybe they're in so-called surplus. Why might governments want to essentially have a stake in the stock market?
Really, two reasons. One is that over the last 40 years, the share of national income that's been going to capital rather than labour has been increasing. And so if governments can gain some exposure to that redistribution of our national income, that's a good thing for governments and communities. But the second thing is that many governments around the world are facing long-term challenges to their public purse. They need to come up with new ways of bringing in revenue to the public coffers, and they need to try and help close the rising gap between revenues that are coming in, but unfortunately much larger expenses going out. So this is another way, not a new source, but maybe an underappreciated source for contemporary governments to try to tap into to help close that gap that's only going to increase over time between revenues and expenses. Some of the more powerful examples of where sovereign funds have been set up and do really connect with their citizen owners are in Alaska and Norway and New Zealand. So Alaska is the only sovereign fund in the world that pays a portion of its returns directly to citizens as a cash dividend.
And that comes from Alaskan oil. Is that paid out to citizens as a dividend? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's a return that's averaged out over the last 5 years. So that tries to control for the fact that, you know, markets fluctuate, returns will go up and down. But the Alaskan government thought it was important that citizens every year had a link to their fund, that they could both monitor the performance of the fund and feel that they had a stake in it. So when they go to pay the dividend, they average out how the fund has performed over the last 5 years and then divide that by the number of people in the state, and then you get your your per capita share, just like a company dividend. And that's literally posted out to you as a check each year or electronic transfer.
You don't know how much that tends to be, do you?
Yeah, it's oscillated between about $1,000 and at its peak about $2,500 over the last 15 years. It's been going since about 1982. But yeah, in the last 15 years with higher oil prices, the fund has become very large and performed very well. And so it's quite a sizable dividend. So, you know, across a family of four or five, you're talking $10,000 extra into the household budget each year, which is a pretty significant sum.
And do these sovereign wealth funds tend to be set up when a country or a state is running a surplus, when there's already money to put aside for them?
It's definitely best practice to make sure that the government is in surplus, because then you're encouraging the savings that are accumulated to be actual savings. There are some examples of funds that have been set up based on the back of debt, and that's a sort of new and emerging model that's mainly been tried out in Asia. But in terms of making sure that we aren't passing on too much of a burden to future generations, ideally, if you can have your government in surplus when you set these funds up, that's ideal.
Talk to us about the Norwegian example, because people may not know, but Norway controls something like, is it 1% of the world's sort of wealth that's invested in stock markets through their fund?
Yeah, exactly right. So Norway is the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world. It's recently surpassed $1 trillion in value. And it's particularly famous for not only that impressive level of equity ownership that you just mentioned, but also for its ethical investment. So it's got a very strong set of responsible investment guidelines, largely as a product of a few more controversial investments that it made early on in its life, much to the displeasure of Norwegian citizens. And it realised that to really feel like a fund that Norwegians had a stake in, it had to earn its returns in a way that citizens approved of. So these strong ethical guidelines are now in place and are the most demanding of any sovereign fund in the world. There's a dedicated ethics council that reviews all of its holdings. And that fund is really therefore at the forefront of the responsible investment movement globally, and really gives citizens a sense that they are actually influencing the allocation of the fund's assets.
Now, the context in the UK, Angela, is, as you probably know, that we've got very deep wealth inequality. It's something like double the levels of income inequality, and that's likely to get worse in the future. Do you think that a sovereign wealth fund could play a role in countering some of that tendency towards wealth inequality?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think sovereign funds and, you know, ideally citizens' funds, if you set up your sovereign fund so it really operates in the interests of citizens, can tackle inequality in two senses. Most of them attempt to store and capture and preserve a portion of public wealth in perpetuity. So it's by definition, they are funds that try to promote intergenerational equality and transfer some of the gains of today to citizens of tomorrow. But you might miss out part of the equation in that, which is tackling some massive inequality issues in the here and now, and inequality that exists sort of intragenerationally today. And sovereign funds can play a role in tackling that inequality as well. In a more radical model, you could actually set them up in a way that helps redistribute the balance of public and private wealth. So some of the more radical suggestions around are seeding a fund in the UK, for instance, by diluting existing share ownership and using those proceeds to set up a fund. Or you could actually just hypothecate a portion of the fund's returns and use them for a redistributive program to citizens today.
What are the key elements that you would recommend if we did a British sovereign wealth fund? What are the key elements you'd recommend for that?
Well, any sovereign fund that's set up that wants to be, in essence, a citizens' fund, not just a fund for the government, but a fund really for the people, has to do three things. It has to be managed in a way that's transparent and accountable, such that citizens can understand what it's doing and feel that they have a degree of influence over how it behaves. It has to invest in a way that citizens identify with, and at a very minimum not contradict other areas of government policy, but more ambitiously start to move towards that Norwegian model of actually reflecting the values that are within that community of citizens that own the fund. And the third thing is to try to use the returns of a fund so that they actually benefit citizens. There's a number of different ways of doing that. You could do the Alaska dividend model. You could do a Norwegian transfer model where they take a portion of the fund's returns and transfer that directly back into the budget each year. Singapore does something like that as well. Or you can make sure that the fund tries to invest in a way that helps boost economic development domestically. So a number of different ways to make sure that funds benefit citizens through the use of their returns.
I think the interesting thing about this conceptually is what you've just said shows that there are funds that come into government in sort of lumps. So, for example, we had, you know, something like £500 billion of North Sea oil. It was spent on current spending. It wasn't invested in a fund. We've had previous spectrum auctions. One of them under the Labour government was used to pay off debt. What you're sort of saying is that there's a sort of conceptual leap that we need to make in this, which is when you get that kind of windfall for government, it should be invested, not just spent, basically.
Exactly right. So I think you can actually, in the most ambitious version of these funds, do both things. So if paying down debt or debt reduction is a priority for government, there are some interesting models around for how you can use the corpus of these funds to actually net off your gross debt. So that's something that Quebec, for instance, has looked at doing and actually set up through its Quebec Generations Fund. It doesn't actually pay down its debt per se, but the balance of the fund that it has there is used to reduce the overall debt for Quebec. So that's an interesting model. At the same time, it's investing and building the corpus over time. And you could actually then take some of the returns that you get off that netting off fund for current day spending. Not something that Quebec does at present, but that would be a model that a country like the UK that might be interested in both reducing its debt but also trying to generate new revenue streams for government could look to adapt in Britain.
I hate to even ask this question, but if you had to explain to the sort of layperson the way this debt thing works, how does that work?
Well, I mean, it's just literally like if you had your bank account and you have some savings, but you also have your credit card with a big chunky debt on it, you might try to build up more of your savings so that you look at when you want to pay your credit card debt off and you think, all right, well, at the point in time, I actually want to get rid of that debt. I'm not going to do it right now because it doesn't actually work for me today to do that. I need more liquidity today. But I'm building up this big corpus in my savings account just so that scary credit card debt doesn't look quite as bad. It's exactly the same principle that Quebec is using, but they still need to actually use that money in another sense for today.
Now, we might think this idea is an idea of the left, but am I right in thinking that Adam Smith, the famous economist who talked about free markets, was one of the originators of this idea?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So I think he's often not given enough credit, but he was the first to properly distinguish between this idea of the sort of revenue of the people and a fund belonging peculiarly to the sovereign, were his exact words. And it was something that was sort of lost in the Wealth of Nations. It wasn't picked up, that distinction, for a very long time. But today I think it has cross-spectrum appeal amongst political parties. So you've seen governments of all different stripes introduce and set up these funds for very different reasons. Some more conservative governments often find this very attractive in terms of a sort of fiscal responsibility tool, or something that encourages savings, long-term planning in terms of those intergenerational pressures on spending. and governments that are on the sort of left of centre and more progressive leanings really like this as a tool for redistribution potentially, or just equality ameliorating measures and community building ethos. So it really does have a cross-spectrum appeal.
And final question, we have a thing here on the podcast which is called the Jeffocracy. It's what I like to think of as a utopian future where I am the supreme leader. If I was to appoint you minister for setting up a sovereign wealth fund, what is the first thing you would do on day one?
I would get out there and start explaining to citizens why it is that government doesn't own any of the assets it actually holds on their behalf, and why everything that the government has in its coffers is actually theirs, and that's why they need to have a proper stake in it.
Angela, thank you so much for joining us. That was really brilliant. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Can talk about this all day long.
We're joined now by Caris Roberts, who is a senior economist at the IPPR and author of the forthcoming paper, Our Commonwealth, a Citizen's Wealth Fund for the UK. Caris, hello.
Hi, Jeff.
So can you start off by telling us about the scale of the wealth inequality problem that we have in this country and how it impacts on, everyone's life?
Sure. So households in the UK hold wealth in property, in financial assets, in pensions, and also physical wealth. And the UK is a really rich nation. We have £12.8 trillion worth of wealth in UK households, but that's very unevenly divided. So to give you an indication, the top 10% of households own 44% of the nation's wealth, whereas the bottom 50%, that's half of people, own 9%. So it's really starkly divided, and that's particularly true of financial wealth, so things like savings, stocks and shares, financial assets.
And that's not true of comparable countries generally?
It's true that other countries increasingly are starting to resemble the UK, but in the past we've always been a bit of an outlier in having high wealth inequality. There are also some quite specific things about the UK economy that make it more unequal. So, for instance, increasingly home ownership is out of reach for lots of people because we have really high house prices in this country. So that's making wealth inequality worse.
And how did we get to here? What caused it?
Well, to understand what's going on there, one important thing to understand is that as a country, we produce output, we have a national income, and some of that is distributed to people in the form of wages, so that goes to workers. But the other part of national income goes to people who own capital, so that's businesses, you might own shares in businesses, as well as machinery, and that goes to them in the form of profits. And what we've seen since the late 1970s is that the proportion of our national output that's going to workers in the form of wages is going down. So more of the pie is going to the people who own capital. That wouldn't be a problem if everyone could own capital. But actually in the UK, as I've said, financial wealth is very unequally distributed. So that means that we're increasingly seeing the wealthy who own capital getting more of the pie.
So that's the scale of the problem. Can you tell us what some of the possible solutions are to this?
Sure. So in the context of the proportion of income going to workers declining, there are a few things you can do. You can try and reverse that decline. So you can have collective bargaining, for instance, through trade unions trying to push up the amount of income that goes to workers. You can try and slow the growing gap between people who own capital and those who don't, for instance, through the tax system. So you could tax capital more effectively. At the moment, we don't do that very well. The rate of tax on capital gains, for instance, is lower than the tax that everyone pays when they go out to work. And the third is that actually to say if taxing wealth is difficult, we could spread around the capital more fairly so that everyone can own wealth and receive an income from it, not just a few people. And there are a few different ways you can do that, which we can talk about in more detail, but that includes helping people to own the businesses that they work for through employee ownership, collectives and mutuals. But it also includes the potential for a sovereign wealth fund or a citizen's wealth fund. And that's what our report is looking at.
Are those two things different, a sovereign wealth fund and a citizen's wealth fund?
They are, yeah. So lots of countries have set up sovereign wealth funds, but a citizen's wealth fund is a specific kind. And it's saying, rather than the government owning this fund, it's owned by citizens, and therefore the citizens should have control of how it's invested, how it's grown, and also how the rewards are spent.
And what does that mean? So say we had a citizens' wealth fund, mm-hmm. You know, we can't have a referendum every time they're deciding whether they should buy some Marks and Spencer shares or they should put it in Ugandan government bonds. Like, what does that mean, the citizens having more control of it?
So the way we think that could work is, firstly, through having a kind of right to share in the proceeds, which could only be changed through legislation, so not just at the whim of a politician at any time, but also in terms of democratically setting restrictions on what the fund could invest in. So, for instance, lots of funds now place restrictions on investment in arms manufacturers and tobacco companies and environmentally damaging business activities, because we don't want to generate income if that's what it takes. We'd rather operate within the ethical constraints set by society.
So it's like your country's values, and Norway is an example of this, are reflected in what you invest in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is one way of thinking about this, if we had in the past put our North Shore revenues into stocks and shares, it would have then created a fund which we could have then used the dividends from? Is that right?
Exactly.
For certain purposes?
Exactly. So if we'd invested the returns that the government received from oil revenues in the 1980s, we would have actually had a fund worth £500 billion today. And that's because it would have earned interest and it would have grown commensurate with that interest. What that would have done is spread out that income over several generations, rather than saying, okay, people in the 1980s, you can have a tax cut, you can have increased spending. We're going to spread that out so that all generations can benefit from our shared oil wealth.
And is that the big difference, just carrying on with that idea of the North Sea oil? So it was spent year by year. You're saying it could have been invested in the stock market, mm-hmm. and presumably. The one difference is you obviously keep the fund available for future generations, mm-hmm. but presumably there's another difference, which is that government is sort of sharing the rising wealth of the stock market with that money. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Exactly. So particularly since the crash, we've actually seen the return on equities being incredibly high.
The stock market, in other words, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if we had been investing money, we would have got a return that was quite a lot higher than the opportunity cost of putting that money into investment.
So the principle here is government, as a sort of expression of the citizens in general, shares in the growing sort of wealth of the country and then gets to do something with that money, yes?
Yes.
Now, how might we raise the money to do that in the future? Because the North Sea oil revenues, unfortunately, more or less gone. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the sort of Norway option in the same way. So how might we raise that money?
So it's true that we missed our opportunity with North Sea oil, but we do have other assets that it would be good to keep as assets on the public balance sheet, and potentially new assets as well as revenues that we could raise. So we think that a mixture of these sources of income and of assets could generate a fund worth approximately $190 billion in 2030. And that would come from a range. So you could, for instance, transfer the remaining RBS shares that the government holds into the fund. You could transfer the Crown Estate into the fund. And
just on this RBS point, I mean, the government's saying it's going to make quite a lot of money on those shares already. It's got it written into its future figures, hasn't it? It's the tens of billions, is that right?
Yes, so it's about 29 billion, I think, at the moment. And some of that they've got plans for, so you'd need to, you know, adjust spending accordingly. But other parts of it they don't have plans for. But then in terms of, so we missed out on North Sea oil, but there might be future assets which could generate income for us. So in particular, spectrum sales, they've previously raised billions, and we will be doing new spectrum auctions in future. So we have existing public assets, which we might want to put in one fund to be better managed. So those, for instance, include the Crown Estate. There's approximately £13 billion.
And just explain what the Crown Estate is to people. I had a little bit of experience of the Crown Estate when I was the energy secretary, mm-hmm. Because they were doing some funding of offshore wind projects. But just explain a bit. What the Crown Estate is basically the money of the sovereign, of the Queen.
Yeah. So it's essentially the Queen's wealth that she has gifted to the people and we then pay her some money back out of. So we'd still, you know, short of destroying the monarchy, we'd need to keep paying some money back mm-hmm. to her, but we could put that money into this fund to generate potentially a stronger income in a bigger fund. But there are other sources as well. So we've been looking at new taxes that could potentially fund a sovereign wealth fund. One of those is a scrip tax, which is an idea that was discussed a lot in Sweden in the 1970s. And it would ask firms to issue new shares in order to put it into the sovereign wealth fund. So say you issue 3% of shares and we'll use that for our fund. And that would directly provide the fund with a stake in lots of different businesses.
And if your business, you're going to think that sounds pretty awful, but presumably is this corporation tax is very low in mm-hmm. the United Kingdom. It's heading towards 17% at the moment,
mm-hmm.
Current plans. Is this a way of taxing corporations perhaps in a slightly different way? Is that right?
It's slightly different. It dilutes shareholder wealth rather than asking them to give their working capital. Our work has shown that actually UK businesses could withstand a little bit of an extra corporation tax. As you say, it is low compared to other countries and historically. So a small scrip tax would allow a substantial size for the fund. One of the other most important taxes that we think could fund the Sovereign Wealth Fund is actually looking at taxes on wealth. So with increasing wealth inequality, as I said, one of the ways to address that is to tax wealth more effectively. And in particular, one way that we think would be very promising is reforming inheritance tax. So reforming it into a gift tax that's harder to avoid throughout your life. And putting that into a fund would be saying, we're going to take people's inheritance and share it more fairly between people who all benefit from the fund.
Just explain what a gift tax is.
A gift tax is a tax when you receive a gift from a family member or from anyone else. So it's taxed on the person receiving the gift, not the person giving the gift. And you would pay tax on any gift throughout your life, not just when someone dies.
So at the moment, if I had £1 million, I could just give it to my son. And providing I didn't die within a few years, he doesn't pay any tax on that.
Exactly.
Right.
So 7 years is the limit.
There's some of the ideas about raising the money. What would you then say could slash should be done with the money? I mean, it could just sit there as a source of government funds, but what have you got ideas about what would be done with the money?
Yeah, so we've worked out that looking at comparable sovereign wealth funds, most of them generate around 4% after inflation in the long term. So looking at a kind of 10 to 20 year time.
So that's what they call a 4% return. That's the annual amount exactly. they get back each year, yes?
The 4% real yeah. return. And that's about $7.5 billion a year, looking at the size of fund that we are, $190 billion by 2030. There are a number of things you could do with that. You could put it into current expenditure, for instance, to go towards public services. But the option that we think is really exciting is actually giving that money directly back to citizens. So saying everybody can have a share of that return, just like if you owned capital individually, that you'd get income from it and pay that out in a dividend. And the structure that we think that should take is to pay to all young people a one-off lump sum dividend.
That includes you, Jeff.
Being a young person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that not just sort of screw up the market? Is it if you give everybody £10,000, doesn't it just make all property?
This would be 25-year-olds. You give £10,000 to one idea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, if you look at the moment, what we do, we give people money in the form of benefits, and we aren't concerned about how that's screwing up the market. We give that to them how they like to spend it. And at the moment, we also give people wealth in the form of the Help to Buy scheme, which gives people money for a house. But that only helps people who can get a mortgage. What we're saying is that whether you get wealth shouldn't depend on your ability to get a mortgage. Everybody should get a £10,000 payment to do as they will.
And just to give a context to this, you used the figures earlier about the net wealth figures for each in percentage terms for the population. If you think about it for in terms of the actual amount each member of the population has, this will make a huge difference.
Exactly. So in the bottom 50% of households in the UK, they have an average of £3,200. So receiving £10,000...
An average of £3,200 of wealth.
Of wealth, exactly. Yeah. £10,000 will have a really transformative effect for those people. And particularly for young people as they're starting out in life. It's 25 is the time when you're looking to invest in your future. You might want to start saving towards a house. You might want to invest in education, perhaps pay off debts, or even just get a computer so that you can start a business. when we look at successful businesses, the shared feature of entrepreneurs is actually that they had capital with which to start that business. So having a bit of money at the beginning of your life can just enable opportunity in a way that a small amount of income wouldn't.
And what would you say to people who say, look, it's just a sort of windfall of £10,000, money for nothing for all these 25-year-olds like Jeff?
I'd say this is our collectively owned wealth, and it's people's right to see the benefits of that money. And when other people, wealthy people, give money to their children, we don't say that's money for nothing. We accept that as a valid thing to do. Likewise, when people see increases in their wealth, we don't say that's money for nothing. That's a valid part of the economy. So I would say it's the 25-year-old's right to receive that income, and they can do with it as they will.
And I think I'm right in saying that this dates back to, is it Thomas Paine, the radical pamphleteer?
Yes,
who
exactly.
First proposed this citizens'
in the 18th century.
Dividend yeah. In the 18th century.
Yeah, and that was based on the premise that we all collectively own the land, and so we should all benefit from the returns to the land.
And how transformative do you think the effect of this could be on the wealth inequality and all of those issues?
I think it could be very transformative. So at the moment, the situation we have is that some young people will enter adulthood and will go through their adult lives with money from their parents and money from their grandparents, and they will have that inheritance. What this would do is say that actually everyone should have this minimum amount of inheritance. It would also, I think, change the way that people thought about our economy and our wealth. It would say, actually, we all own a stake in this and we all deserve a return. And potentially, as the fund developed, if it owned more of the economy, we could start seeing greater elements of the public having control over the economy and actually deciding what happens with those businesses that the public's invested in.
And there's something here, isn't there, about just going back to this North Sea oil analogy that, you know, Norway put its money aside in order to benefit the country and have now got $1 trillion worth of wealth fund. We spent it sort of every year and now it's gone. And there's something about sort of investing for the future in this, isn't there?
Definitely. People will have seen in the news that intergenerational inequality is a big issue at the moment. Some young people just won't see the kinds of stable incomes and wealth that their parents did. So what this is saying is we will save some of that wealth that we have generated as a country and make sure that future generations and everyone in those future generations can benefit from it.
Karis, thank you so much. And just so people can read the full proposals when they come out, when should they be expecting that?
We're publishing a report over the Easter weekend, so it will be available on the IPPR website.
Karis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Well, look, it's a really interesting discussion. I think there's sort of three separate but related questions here, which is, should we have a sovereign wealth fund? How do we capitalise it? And what do we do with the money? On the first, I'm really struck by the North Sea oil example. You know, if we'd put the money aside, we'd now have a $500 billion fund, which we could democratically decide what to do with.
But that is a big if, and how often do those things, those kind of windfalls, come along?
Well, that is true, although governments do sell off, you know, 4G, 5G, 6G, you know, spectrum, realising our stake in RBS, you know, all of that stuff. And the question is there like a pot into which you put it for the long term, or is it you just sort of spend it?
Well, that's difficult, isn't it? Especially when you're talking about a country that's had this deficit and we've had these years of austerity. Mm. In a way, that's a difficult sell to say, oh, we've got this money, but we're not going to use it to fix these problems now.
Right.
We're going to make sure that future generations benefit from it, which is a good way of thinking.
Yes.
I think like if more governments thought about what would happen in 10 or 20 years, and instead of thinking, oh, somebody else will be in government by then, it's going to be their problem, yeah, that would be a good thing.
I mean, presumably that's what they were saying in the 1980s, well, we need to deal with these issues now.
Yeah.
They were paying lots of people unemployed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they didn't put the money aside.
Mm.
And then there's a question about how you capitalize it, and there's obviously these sources that I've talked about. There's also this shares idea,
and I don't know, so I think, you know, I like the sound of that. I can imagine that some of our listeners are going to balk slightly at the idea of being forced by the government,
yeah,
to release more shares, and also maybe the idea of there being this wealth that the government are deciding how it should be invested.
Look, there's no question that there's a certain level of controversy to that idea, although you could always give companies the choice about how, whether they paid it in corporation tax or in shares. And the Norwegian example is pretty inspiring. Like on climate change, they're leading some of the efforts to make companies go green using their money. Now, companies might find that more threatening, but I think there is a long-term case for it. And then there's the question of what to do with the money. As a borderline millennial, you should go first.
Well, I do think something that addresses this problem that future generations won't be as wealthy as the generations that preceded them, you know, that sounds like the way to be thinking about it, doesn't it?
I agree. And you know, look, we're taking on one of the knottiest problems here. We've got massive wealth inequality, and the cascade of wealth that is going to go down the generation is going to make that worse. It's set to make it worse. And so I think what's good about this proposal is it's thinking deeply about how do you counter some of that, so that, you know, you don't have young people completely priced out of the housing market. You know, only young people with like money from their parents can either afford to buy a house, set up a business, have something to fall back on. And I think that's what it's trying to address. And there's also something interesting here, which is the Labour government did set up this Child Trust Fund in 2002. It's going to come to fruition in 2020. Now, it was sort of cut off in its prime, but there'll be some people who've invested in that, and I guess we'll get to see some of the results of that idea in practice from 2020 onwards.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. You can email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or on Facebook.
Frazzles.
We had frazzles.
Facebook. We want to know your favourite crisps.
.com/reasons to be cheerful.
What's it? I didn't think of that one.
It feels like you're malfunctioning.
What?
Like some kind
the
of
robot's
you're
gone
short-circuiting
wrong.
Yeah, and you're just naming crisps.
I have, sorry.
This comes from Amanda Summers, who says, "Dear Ed and Jeff, I was especially interested in the recent episode on homelessness. I work with a community group in Derby who aim to support homeless and vulnerable people. The group goes into the city centre 3 evenings a week, providing hot food, clothing and a friendly ear to those who need it. We regularly see an excess of 70 people per night. Many are homeless, but the majority are vulnerable people who find once they've paid their rent, etc., have little left for food and clothing. I think this serves to illustrate how figures on homelessness are the tip of the iceberg when it comes to looking at the wider issue of poverty." At the end of the email, she adds, "By the way, as someone who is allergic to both cucumber and tomatoes, I'm totally with Ed on the sandwich thing." Now, I for a long time have suspected that I've had a intolerance to cucumber, but people make fun of me for it, saying,
"I know, but the problem is that's the problem of not having the choice of what you want in your sandwiches." I mean, that is basically my point.
Because cucumbers are 70% water, and people say, well, you can't be allergic.
I quite like cucumbers and tomatoes, but that's the whole thing about individuality. On her point about homelessness, I think it is worth sort of underlining what Amanda's saying, which is, you know, there are lots of people going out there doing fantastic stuff with the homeless. I was at an event last night, and I didn't realise this, but a quarter of young people who are homeless are LGBT.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's disproportionate.
It was for a benefit for the Albert Kennedy Trust I was at. It was a showing of this play called The York Realist at the Dolmar Warehouse. But, you know, I mean, it's quite, you know, alarming and striking figure.
So relationships with families break down.
Relationships with families break down. And the Albert Kennedy Trust does great work with LGBT young people. The next one is from David Binns, and the subject is, "You gave me a heart attack, LOL. Dear Ed and Jeff, I'm writing to say thank you for the show and tell you how much I love it. I listen to Pod Save America too, but I always listen to yours first. I last sent you an email just after," which is good to hear.
Yes.
"I last sent you an email just after Christmas about my hopes for a change in the study of economics. So imagine my childlike wonder that the very first episode after Christmas was all about hopes for a change in the study of economics. With great excitement, on the morning of 15th of January, I listened to your show while making a start on boarding out my loft. It's a great show as ever, but I didn't get a mention. I was stoic in the face of adversity. My wife was furious. Later that day, I had a heart attack. Now, I'm not saying I blame the pair of you, but at what point does correlation become causation?"
It's a good question. I hope we haven't got a lawsuit on our hands.
"I was whisked off to Papworth, where the emergency team sucked out the offending blood clot from my right coronary artery and fitted me with two shiny new stents. I turned 40 last summer, and so like Jeff, I'm disaffected late generation Xer, but with no history of smoking, no excess weight beyond the usual midlife paunch, and
don't look at me like that.
And no real indications," I've got that problem too, "and no real indications that something was amiss. It all came as a bit of a shock." I mean, we're obviously really pleased to hear that David is recovered, because he says he has recovered. He goes on to say, and we thought we should definitely, you know, read out his email, but he goes on to say that his reason to be cheerful is the millennials, which I think is great. And he's not including himself in that category, Jeff, just in case you wondered. He says lots of things about millennials, but he says the millennials, I think, are growing up to be exceptionally good critical thinkers, because they're growing up in a society world where they have to be, in capitals. They need to develop abilities to sift and sort the accurate from the invented, and sift and sort the relevant from the irrelevant. It's something they have to deal with every day on an ongoing basis. Well, David, really pleased to get your email, really pleased that you're better, and really sorry that we may have contributed to your problems.
Worrying about my paunch now.
Yeah, well, indeed.
You're making me very self-conscious.
But the answer to this is for us to, you know, do this exercise together. Both of us in sort of appropriate costumes, you know, yoga, Pilates.
This all sounds very Laurel and Hardy.
It does, really.
Yeah.
Hardy and Hardy.
This comes from Amelia Wilson, who says, "I was recently listening to your buses episode whilst waiting and waiting and waiting for my bus to work here in Cayenne, and it got me thinking about how much less reliable so many of the services are in French Guiana than in the French metropole."
I mean, that is pretty amazing, isn't it? We've got a listener in French Guiana.
Do you say Guiana?
Oh, I don't know.
We were hedging our bets here. One of us is saying it one way, the other saying it, whichever one's right.
Yeah.
She goes on to say, "The education system here is severely lacking too. Provision for students beyond the age of 15 is simply non-existent in many parts of the region, and secondary schools do not benefit from the same resources as their metropolitan counterparts. Poverty is also rife with a significant number of people living in small shanty towns. It's scandalous to me that all of this is going on in what's supposed to be France. I'd be keen to know if it's at all similar in British overseas territories, or if they're mostly tax havens exclusively populated by the very wealthy. Perhaps you could do an episode on the subject." That's an interesting question, actually, because of course very wealthy people, you know, they have their places in those tax havens, but very wealthy people like people to cook and clean for them, and what are living conditions
like? Yeah, well, it's
like
a really interesting, question. I'd also like to give a shout out to we have a listener in Madagascar. Not that they've emailed in, but I noticed from our new statistics on Acast, which we're in the platform we're now on, that they tell you so does the other one, but I was just looking at them, and we have one listener in Madagascar, so I'd love to know who they are. Maybe they can email in.
Maybe we can come and visit.
Yeah, exactly. The next one is also from overseas, Wendelin Donnan. Good morning, Ed and Jeff. I've been listening to your podcast here in wintry Waldheim. I hope that's pronounced right. Saskatchewan, that's Canada, and enjoy it immensely. I am completely against Goop. I like the idea of the MYO sandwich idea, and there was a setup similar to this in the cafe near where I worked about 15 years ago. Unfortunately, this is grist to your mill, Jeff, it was stopped due to occupational health and safety issues. This shop employed recovering addicts, students looking for work experience, and the underemployed. I love this idea and would make every effort to go to the shop, even though I could have made my own lunch at home. It's a good thing. Thank you muchly, Wendelin. You see, look, it's a big movement out there.
The common thread seems to be, we've had a lot of email now from people who say, there used to be a place like this near me, but it closed down.
It collapsed.
Yeah.
Due to either health or economic issues. Do you think Frazzles do you think they've ever kind of come across sort of bacon or pigs?
I don't think so. I think most of those things.
Or engineered flavour.
Yeah, you have to check, but most of them have suitable for vegetarians.
Really?
On them. Yeah, most of them, not all of them. How do you feel about crisps on a sandwich?
Definitely not.
But would
on
you...
the side, maybe, but not on the sandwich.
No, it's a layer, then you press it down, get a nice little crunch.
I don't think so. That's why you need to make your own.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at Cheerful Podcasts, or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
So we are on our trip to Vienna, and we're sitting in, I can't ever remember sitting in a more spectacular office, can you?
It's nicer than mine.
It's much nicer than yours, no offence. I mean, you've been
The biscuits are nicer than mine as well, actually.
You've been in the Oval Office. I mean, this is going to be nicer than the Oval Office, right?
It competes with the Oval Office.
It's the most incredible office. It's in City Hall in Vienna, and it is the office of Jürgen Czernohorsky. Now, have I said that right?
Yes, it's like chair, no horse and key.
You've made it very easy for English speakers because you have it broken down phonetically on your Twitter page.
Yeah, because it's also hard for Austrian people to pronounce it correctly.
But this office is stunning. There's a dartboard on the wall, but an electronic fancy one. You've got a guitar over there. You've got a beautiful neon sign.
We should say what your neon sign spells out. Just spell it out for us and then say what it means.
Okay, in German it's Verändern wir die Welt. And in English, that would mean let's change the world, which is basically doing politics.
It's good. So one of the things we wanted to talk to you about is Vienna, because you are obviously have a position of responsibility within the government here. And Vienna has been named the best place to live for 8 years in a row.
We are very proud of it.
Well, yeah, I bet you are. Rightly. Why? I don't mean why are you proud. Why has it been named the best place to live for all that time?
Well, I think there are hundreds of reasons, but the most important thing is you can live in a great way in every city in the world when you are well off. And the great thing about Vienna is you can live there and love it there and work there and have an affordable rent when you're a worker or when you're just not winner of social bingo.
So in a way, you're bucking the trend for all of these capital cities around the world, like New York, Paris, London, where you've got to be rich for it to be anything other than a difficult life.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of our most important political goals to work for a city where you can feel at home in every district and in every place in every region. And I mean, it's hard work, but I think working for a city that is not falling apart is one of the most important things to do.
And one of the things that stands out, and you mentioned it, is housing. More than 80% of residents in Vienna rent. I think about 60% live in municipal or publicly subsidized housing. Tell us more about how this housing scheme works.
First of all, it's a tradition. Vienna is famous for the period of Red Vienna. It's from the ending of the First World War to the beginning of the fascist state in 1934, and that was a period when Viennese politicians decided to raise money and put it into as many affordable flats as possible, and we kept on doing that. At this time, 60% of the Viennese people live in municipal flats or publicly subsidized flats. And on top of that, there are rent caps. There is a system of rent controls for the private market as well.
And just on this question of rent caps in the private sector, because there's a debate about this in Britain, does that work? Because some people would say, well, that means the private sector won't have any incentive to provide the housing, landlords won't want to provide the housing if there's rent caps and so on.
In my point of view, it works perfectly well. I mean, Vienna is a fast-growing city, so there is the necessity to build, and it works, and the private companies build, and the city builds. It's true that 8 out of 10 newly built flats in this year are in some way subsidized by the city. So that's a really huge part of work done by ourselves.
But basically, it's a relatively low percentage of people's income that people are paying in rent compared to London or...
On average, the Viennese pay up to 25% of the household income for living.
Much more reasonable.
And can you tell us about the Viennese and maybe the Austrian attitude towards home ownership? I mean, it's just not considered in the same way as it is in the UK?
I don't know why. I think most of all, there are two reasons why so many people rent their flats. First of all, it's so expensive to buy a flat. And second is it's safe to rent one because the prices don't go up very, very quickly in 10 or 20 or 30 years. So it's just, I mean, it's a calculation. And most of the people add and think it's easier to rent.
Tell us what else is good about Vienna. Because, you know, it's not just the housing that people have focused on. Tell us some of the other things that you're proudest of, which you think has meant that you've won this award so many years in a row.
Compared to other metropolitan areas, the level of segregation is low and the quality of public schools is very high. And that is, I think it's another reason why Viennese tend to love their region, their district where they live, because it's great all over the all
and
over
how
city.
Have you managed that integration? Is that, because I know that's one of your responsibilities is around integration. Is that because of the housing or is it because of wider attempts at integration?
I would say everything's interlinked and it's a really big challenge because Vienna is fast growing and definitely there are areas with a much higher percentage of pupils having to learn German and having parents that are not able to help them with it. But as there are no real no-go areas like suburbs or gated communities in Vienna, it's also the school that is rather well mixed.
But something amazing here is consistency of government. So the Social Democrats have been in power in Vienna for how long?
Yeah, whenever there was democracy, there were Social Democrats in Vienna.
Since 1945, since the end of the Second World
War. Yeah, from 1919 to 1934 and from 1945 till the present day.
I mean, apart from good government and all that, what explains Social Democratic success?
Maybe it's something very, for people in Vienna, it's something very normal. Things tend not to break down. Public transport system, the tram system. It's very easy to and very, very cheap to come from point A to point B because it's an annual ticket is costs only €1 per day. For the whole public transport system. So Vienna is basically it's just a good place to live.
I know you're about to come to London. Air quality is a massive problem in London. Is there anything we should learn from what you're doing in Vienna?
Yeah, I mean, Vienna, first of all, which is hard to organize when it's not the case already, but first of all, Vienna is very green, and in the last 100 years we managed to preserve the parks and the woods, even if there was more and more pressure on housing capacity. Then Vienna is a city of short distances and a very good public transport system and low housing costs. That leads to the fact that there is not that much commuting because people can live inside the city and work in the city, so they can use the public transport to go from A to B.
So while we're here, I mean, our trip to Vienna is very short, but we want to find a good coffee house. Where do you recommend?
Well, if you want to have it in walking distance, as Vienna is the city of walking distances, it's just over the place here. It's Café Eiles. Basically, it used to be my office for 10 years.
We shall go off there and have a coffee, won't
Absolutely.
We?
Absolutely.
You should. And have some Apfelstrudel.
Oh.
Definitely. Jürgen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's so great to talk to you.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, we mentioned at the beginning of the episode that we'd had our first successful trip away together, and we're going to be on the road a hell of a lot this year, you and I.
We are.
You've got a list of our upcoming engagements in front of you.
So, it's just been announced that we are doing Latitude on Sunday the 15th of July.
I'm so excited about that.
I know, you wanted a free ticket to Latitude, so that you decided you'd have to do a show there.
Yeah, and it worked. Have you been to that festival before?
I have once as climate change secretary, yeah.
It's fun. It's such a lovely festival, and they have sheep.
Sheep.
At the festival, yeah.
Maybe we can get the sheep involved. Right. There are some tickets left for Bristol on Friday, April the 13th. We're in Sheffield on Friday, April the 27th. As I say, we're doing Latitude. We're also going to be doing the Lunar Festival. That's on Saturday, 28th of July in Tamworth. We're going to be doing Edinburgh on that first weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 4th and 5th of August. And there are a few other dates within the next few months that we'll be announcing soon as well.
We should buy a van.
True. What would we... We'd have our face on it or something.
Yeah, like emblazoned on the side, yeah. Lads on Tour.
Yeah.
We should have got Lads on Tour t-shirts for our trip to Austria, really.
I don't think we're really lads.
No, I don't think we really are.
Yeah. It just doesn't quite sort of, you know... You don't drink. You know, I'm really square. I mean, I think we're quite a long way from Lads on Tour. I hate to be the sort of party pooper here. But.
So we should thank our guests this week. Who were?
Angela Carmine, author of Citizens Wealth, Karis Roberts, research fellow at the IPPR.
And also Jürgen Czernohorski from Vienna.
Follow him on Twitter.
Yeah. Just look up Czernohorski. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed did the music. James Deacon made our idents. Bumped into him this morning, actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he's about to become a father again for the second time.
Oh, good. How are his idents? Excellent.
Yeah, he's clearly identified.
Yeah.
And Emily Power made our artwork.
Emma Caution produced our podcast with backup and research by Alex Weiss-Price and Lindsay Todd.
He's been a cheesy what's-it.
He's been a wheat crunchy.
He's a bean.
Reasons to be frazzled.